it has had a major impact on me as far as my own journey goes, because by them allowing me to interview them makes me feel that I do have a purpose and I can still contribute.
Welcome to this episode of the Here and Now podcast. My name is Dave Mons. I'm a student of psychology and philosophy and a professional pilot. My aim is to share big ideas from science and the humanities to get you thinking and to help you make sense of the world. Joining me today is Patrick Bronte. Pat is a Kiwi who lives in my hometown of Palmerston North in New Zealand. His story is a little different from most, and it would be an understatement to say that he's experienced his fair share of challenges. Pat is not defined by his personal story, rather his life has been dedicated to collecting the stories of others, and in particular New Zealand Armed Service Veterans, and what is known as the Ngatoa Project, which is the Māori word for many warriors. So in this episode, we're going to discuss a bit about Pat's life's work with Ngatoa and his mission of gathering first-hand accounts from hundreds of soldiers, sailors and airmen, and how this has influenced his life and is guiding him forward. Pat Bronte, thanks for coming on the Here and Now podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. Perhaps you could just give me a little bit of your own background and then lead me into the project, how it got started and how you became interested in recording the stories of veterans.
Yeah, well, from a young age, I was fortunate enough to have a father who was very much into history, and he tried to install those benefits of reading and research into me, which I sort of rejected at first because I was too interested in sports and just the usual kind of teenage type stuff. At the age of 16, I ended up breaking my neck when I took a wrong dive into a river, and that left me paralyzed from the shoulders down. And so there was a big question mark as to what was the future going to hold for me, because I had two sort of opposing plans. One was to either follow my mother and become a teacher, because I had the experience of coaching a primary school hockey team, and I really enjoyed that. And the other was to join the army as a infantryman. As a result of the accident, none of those really eventuated. So to give you a bit of background on how the project started, I'd just seen the movie Saving Private Ryan, which had quite a significant impact on me as to with the realism and great production standards that Spielberg produced with that film. It just happened that the day after, Dad had arranged the books all over the table for me to read up all about D-Day, and then he had a visit from one of his old friends who quite a bit older than him, and I just turned around and said to him, like, hey Bones, were you in the war? And he said yes, and then I asked him if he'd talk about it, and he said, oh, only to those who are interested. And then he commented on the amount of books that were on the table, and from there he and his friend Charlie would come and visit me every Sunday afternoon for about 8 weeks, and they shared everything with me as to their experiences during World War II. And quite often I wouldn't even have to ask any questions. I could just sit back and just listen to them talk amongst themselves, argue amongst themselves, disagree, or come up with alternative scenarios that they thought would have worked best for our contribution to World War II. And that was, you know, a gin or two always helped in those cases. So they really helped me out of the hole that I was in, because after hearing their experiences and, you know, even having Charlie take his shirt off and show me all his bullet wounds that he'd survived, I just sort of thought that my situation was nothing compared to what these two men had been through. And so from then I stopped feeling sorry for myself and became determined to make a life for myself.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing. We often hear this idea about that others die so that we can live, you know, the freedom that has been fought for. And obviously these guys came back. But that's a really such a vivid example of that, in a way that you've got a situation where you're facing a lot of struggles yourself. And as you say, uncertain future, and to be inspired by guys who've been and done that, and they've come back to tell the tale and tell it to you, is an amazing, humbling experience. I can understand how this has led to this project evolving from there.
Yeah, so fast forward a couple of years, I started at university and I had developed a very a deep interest in film, and the only thing that was on offer at the university which I decided to attend was media studies. And so I started doing that. And I did a paper on media practice, which was basically showing us the ropes on how what it takes to actually produce music videos, news shows, short film. And although I can't use the camera myself, when being exposed to the use of cameras, the editing suite and the whole process, it made me think about Charlie in particular, because he used to slam his fist on the table a lot. And I felt that by using a camera as opposed to just a dictaphone, I would be able to capture the body language of Bones and Charlie. So it started off with me just going back and interviewing them and recording them on camera for myself, for something to look back to if I was struggling in life at any time. But then after finishing that first interview, they said to me, oh, you need to talk to your grandmother's next door neighbour, he's got a great story. So I did, and then it just snowballed, and 18 years later I'm still doing it. Okay, I am preserving New Zealand's historical heritage, and because one of the big themes that I've found is that war and society are highly linked together. So I found that you could learn a lot about society through interviewing returned servicemen, because when talking to World War II veterans, for example, when finding out a bit about their background, I would find out a lot about what it was like to live through the, you know, the Great Depression. Or if I interviewed a Vietnam veteran, I would find out what it was like to live during those tumultuous years in the 60s. So I felt that what I was doing was in some way contributing back in a way in which I felt that I could become a standard contributing member of society. Whether at that stage those first recordings were of any value or not, it still gave me a feeling of that I wasn't just living off the government's welfare, and I was, you know, giving something back with that. Comes secondary to the fact that I was meeting such amazing people who in themselves were very inspiring to me, and, you know, helped me immensely sort of get over the obstacles that I had to deal with.
So you're saying before about the link, say, between society and war, and I guess what I interpret you to mean by that is about talking to these guys and the language they use and the way they describe the context of when they were going to war and how it felt. It's almost it's not just about their experiences in war, but these are people describing a time, a period in history. You get this more of a sense of the sort of epoch that they were living in when they went to this war, and the way society, sort of the values and norms of society that shaped how they approached things and what they came back to.
Yes, exactly. And another point is that when you mentioned what they came back to, is that it was these very men and women that helped shape the society that we live in today.
Sure.
And then the next generation of veterans, say from Korea, did the same, and those from Borneo, Vietnam continued that. So there was just a lot more. There's just a lot more wealth to the experiences of war and conflict.
In recent years, it seems there's been a lot more people turning up for the Anzac Day dawn parades and so on than there used to be in the past, like huge crowds of people. Have you got any idea why that is? Why do you think that is? Why are people suddenly starting to think about this more?
My personal belief is that this is a result of the grandfathers and fathers of World War I and World War II veterans passing on, and the families not taking an interest in what they went through when they were alive, so therefore have gone and tried to find more about their genealogy once they've passed. That's my own assumption.
Yeah.
But it is very noticeable. But in saying that, one of the things that does come across loud and clear is that the focus is solely on World War One, World War Two, and of course Vietnam, due to the controversy involved in that conflict. But yep. Therefore, veterans from the Korean War, and deployments to Borneo and Malaya, and especially operational deployments post Vietnam, have been neglected as far as the social narrative goes. So what I mean by that is that the public doesn't seem to – well, there doesn't seem to be anything out there that the public can access to give them a good understanding of what our contemporary veterans have been contributing to peacekeeping missions or peace enforcement missions that New Zealand's involved with. I mean, quite often at any one time – the New Zealand Defence Force may have personnel in 14 different countries, and I always wonder how well known that is to the public.
If you're not actively seeking that information out by subscribing to Defence Force publications or newsletters or like them on Facebook and things like that, then you're really unaware of that sort of stuff going on. And I think as well, maybe the nature, like you mentioned, Vietnam, the First and Second World Wars, they're obviously well-known events. There's a lot of films about them, and a lot of people did have a relative who was somehow involved, and obviously the notoriety surrounding Vietnam and some of the lesser-known conflicts and even the more recent ones, where the role that New Zealand has played has been relatively small but has still been significant. And we only tend to see some of the downsides of it. I think just recently in the news there was the trial or the discussion surrounding the SAS patrol and some sort of poor leadership, or certainly allegations of that. And so people tend to see only negative sides of these sorts of conflicts as well, rather than what is really being done, whether it's in part because of the sort of the secret nature of some of the special forces operations, but even just the scope of things. You know, a peacekeeper's role, I don't think people really understand what that means and the what actually goes into it. You know, people think, well, what are these guys doing, just standing around, you know, not doing much at all? But there's certainly been plenty of stress for the guys who are out there working in those austere environments, and there's always uncertainty around it as well. So, you know, these are still important stories to cover. I saw that you have been working with some of the SAS guys and more contemporary times from within the last 20 years. Is that true? Have you started a dialogue with some of the more recent veterans as well?
Not so much with the SAS, but I have started to record those experiences from veterans that have served on behalf of New Zealand in the last 20 years. And one thing that has come across loud and clear is that although we may have a very small defence force and limited budget, which therefore means the amount of troops that we are able to deploy may be small, but their contribution is very significant, and it's very well recognised by the big players in recent conflicts, like the United States, for example. Our SAS got a presidential citation from George W. Bush for their contribution to Operation Enduring Freedom, which was the Afghanistan deployment, which wasn't limited to ground troops within Afghanistan itself. Our Navy contributed significantly to that whole operation by getting involved with tasks that the US Navy was doing within the Persian Gulf to allow them to free up their Navy to support the missions within Iraq and Afghanistan. And what I've found is this is the way that governments speak to one another and nation states speak to one another and prove themselves to one another. Despite any controversy, the impact that New Zealand troops have had in the recent years has really benefited the country as a whole, especially when it comes to things like free trade deals and, you know, diplomatic ties with countries that, I mean, these guys are representing us on the world stage, and it's, you know, comparable to the way the All Blacks do.
Yeah, sure.
But they achieve more than just winning a cup, without taking anything away from the All Blacks, of course.
And how have you found some of the personal stories from the guys coming back from more recent conflict and the roles they've been performing, how they compare with some of the older veterans from Vietnam or the Second World War or so on? Do you see much contrast, or do they tend to speak about their experiences in similar type of ways?
Well, the basic themes are there, but the major difference is that World War II was a very conventional war. And then as we moved into Korea, it was still conventional. But then as we got involved in the Malayan emergency, the Borneo confrontation and the Vietnam War, that's when there was a major shift in the way in which warfare is, or modern warfare is conducted. And so that is a common thread. And although some of the more contemporary veterans within the last 20 years didn't undergo the same kind of, they didn't experience the same intensity as someone that was a part of the Battle of Cassino in Italy during World War II, or any battle during World War II, they still have the same problems that those veterans had when coming back and fitting into society. So they, you know, there's still post-traumatic stress, they're still transitioning into society after being in the Defence Force for some time, and all those things. So, you know, the themes are still there. It's just, I guess you could just say it's just set in a different frame.
Yeah, sure. And so approximately how many of these interviews have you done or told over the years?
I think at this stage my website says 300, but it's probably more close to 400 by now, 400 individuals. And with those, so the average interview I do is runs for about 3 hours.
Wow.
And sometimes it will go on longer, and quite often I'll go back, and that may be due to me going away and thinking about questions that I didn't ask, or finding out a little bit more from another veteran that may have served with that one. And I'll go back and, you know, there's some veterans that I've I've interviewed up to five different occasions. So the number of hours of recordings that I have would be well over 1,500 hours worth of video footage.
Wow. And what's the plan with all of that? How much is that accessible to people, or how much has been used in some other sort of assembly of those, some of those key interviews and any other sort of documentary form?
Well, I've always felt that the state supports me, so therefore I feel that I should be contributing back, and I never felt right making money off recording a veteran's experience. But in saying that, I have received donations and payment for the use of that footage in documentaries, but that all goes back into the trust, which can therefore help me achieve my goal of being able to present these veterans' experiences online, and which is the most accessible format and for no charge at all. The difficulty is that I have a tendency to possibly take on a bit too much, so I may have three or four different projects all related to the veterans community on the go, which I must say has contributed to the lack of material being uploaded onto my Ngātahoa website, which is what I want to use as the platform to enable New Zealanders and the rest of the world to hear firsthand the contribution made by our servicemen and women.
With such a large volume of people that you've spoken to and gathering all these stories and spending, as you say, over 1,500 hours, literally hours and hours, listening to these people's accounts, and I'm sure some of them are quite harrowing at times, what sort of impact does that have on you? How have you found that has affected you personally and emotionally from living through these people's experiences?
Well, in the beginning, you know, it didn't really take too much to blow me away, as you would say, as far as, my God, you went through that. Because I was always the type of kid who, you know, would tag on my grandfather and say, how many Nazis did you kill?
Okay.
You know, a stupid question because he served on a submarine. So okay. to all of his grandchildren's frustration, all he would say was that he just spent all his time waving at mermaids. But as the years have gone on, I have hardened to what a lot of these men have to say, you know, those in frontline combat roles, because I guess it's just a matter of I've heard so many harrowing stories that now it's not about just capturing the, you know, what happens in combat, which is what my major focus was in the beginning. So it's shifted to be able to capture the wider picture. And one of my biggest regrets was that I, because of that interest in finding out about, you know, frontline combat, I neglected the role that women played. And my plans are at the moment is to rectify that when interviewing the more contemporary veterans, because the role that women have played when serving New Zealand on operational deployments in the last 20 years is very significant and not very well known. So I hope to be able to continue recording the experiences of women and make more of an effort to represent them in a way that the public can recognise their service as much as those first men that went and landed on Gallipoli on the 25th of April 1915.
Yeah, that's interesting. Again, it speaks maybe to the shifting social dialogue as well, about thinking of the role that women play in society. War is traditionally thought of as a male-dominated thing, or certainly it has been. Women have contributed in huge part, whether it was at home in the production in the factories during the Second World War, right through to now where they're actively involved in conflicts and all manner of occupations. So it's an important point to make. Commented before that for a lot of the veterans, they've never shared these stories before, and it's something of a cliche of the grandfather who was always quiet and he never spoke about his war experiences, or as you mentioned before, with your grandfather saying that he was just looking for mermaids. Why is it that a lot of these guys have started to share their stories with you, do you think? Is there something you've brought to the conversation, or is it just a case that as they're getting older, they start to feel maybe it's the time to share this while I still can?
Yes, I firmly believe that it was a matter of timing. I came in at a time when the World War II veterans were in their, you know, between the early 80s and late 90s. So I feel that it had come a time where they felt that comfortable to talk about it. And I think based on the feedback I've received that the wheelchair and my disability does help in a way that they can emphasise that I've been through a personal struggle in a similar way that they have. Obviously not to the same extreme, but I think that may possibly have something to do with it. But then in saying that, I've also had feedback from veterans themselves that they find speaking about it to someone that is interested, genuinely interested, not doing it for a job, I'm not earning money from it, and I don't have a formal structure like, say, a government employee or a historian may have to follow. I just sort of sit down and just casual conversation with them, and they've sort of got back to me and found that speaking about it on that level has been quite cathartic. So, you know, that's just a few cases that I know of. So I think that when one veteran speaks to another about speaking to me, that they feel comfortable to speak to me because I've spoken to a mate of theirs who felt comfortable speaking to me, if that makes sense.
Mm. And you've become something of an expert interviewer after all of these interviews, I would have thought. Far more experienced than I am, that's for sure. So how have you found that process in yourself and how your style or technique has evolved? Have you found certain techniques that can get the thing flowing along better, or it's always a case of you just let the veteran tell their story with minimal poking and prodding?
Well, I always start off by asking them, you know, their family history and where they grew up, where they were born and raised, because I feel that that provides a lot of context to the way in which they dealt with the challenges that they faced. And to be honest, yeah, I must say that I possibly do poke and prod a bit, and sometimes the answer's given in a way that it's unoffensive, or sometimes there's a bit of reluctance, but they may answer that question later on down the line. But my interview technique has always been one of just sitting down as if there's no camera there, there's no lights there, there's no microphone. It's just sitting down like I did when I first heard from Bones and Charlie, as I explained earlier. So I've never felt that bringing in things like, well, what happened on this date and those historical facts and figures, they're not worth asking because each individual is only saw a very small part of the wider picture. So I've focused on the personal experience, and I think by doing that shows that I'm trying to recognise each individual's service, and that may have also help when it comes to answering the tough questions or being more open and forthcoming about their entire experience rather than leaving certain bits out.
Yeah, the TV series Band of Brothers I've watched so many times. I just think it's a wonderful recreation of that period for those group of guys. And it's, I think every episode starts with a vignette of one of the veterans recounting his experience, and then they obviously play through the episode after that. And that gives you that very personal insight into what it was like for those guys who were there experiencing this. And it's not from a documentary perspective, even though it's obviously historically accurate. It's not about one of these sort of specials where you watch an hour and a half of all of the sort of the broader scope of what happened and the historical flow of events. It's more the perspective from just the handful of people that were involved in that. And I guess the stories these guys are sharing with you and the wider collection of work is many, many accounts of that, which I think will be really interesting for people to get that very personal insight. And it adds a lot more depth because there's certainly no shortage of historical accounts of the war that have been attended to in various conflicts by historians and documentarians. And often what is missing is those specific voices, the very personal voices of people who were just there living it. And it's often the mundane, not necessarily all of the guts and glory on the battlefield, but just the waiting and the boredom, the time spent on the ships, waiting, the unknown as well of what's going to happen next and wondering about when you're going to get home and hearing about battles and things, the rumor network, and wondering when it's going to be your turn to step up and if you're going to have the courage to be able to do it alongside your brothers and all of that stuff. I'm sure there's just so much of that buried within those stories. You talked earlier about hearing those first stories has made you realize that what you've been through is nothing compared to some of what these guys have been through. And how have you found then this project has given you a sense of purpose or meaning in your own life?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I don't think I would have been able to tackle the obstacles and challenges that come my way in the way that I do had I not had this privilege of meeting such interesting and incredible men and women. So it has had a major impact on me as far as my own journey goes, because by them allowing me to interview them makes me feel that I do have a purpose and I can still contribute to society and to a society that is very generous when it comes to assisting me in navigating my disability. So, and that's what sort of feeds the drive to continue. So it definitely has made had a huge impact on me, both as far as my personal life goes and personal outlook on life, but also that feeling that I've at least captured it and it's recorded. It may not be out there and open to the public, or I may not have got to get a copy of it to the family yet, but at least it's been recorded, and that is a huge reward as far as the time, energy and finances that I've put into the project personally, with the help of my family, of course. And so, yeah, it really has given me purpose, because I can't really think of what I would be up to and how I would view life now had I not been doing this. Because all I could, you know, off the top of my head, all I could think of that I would have done was just become a professional student. It has been an honour and privilege. And when the veteran or the veteran's family gets something out of it, that's the main goal. Just as a byproduct, it has given me a lot of drive to just push aside those challenges that I face and focus on just being me and not me and my disability.
It's amazing that you found that motivation. I think it was the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. He said, "A man with a why can endure almost anyhow." And I think you're definitely a living example of that, that's for sure. And it just goes to show how important it is to find that sense of meaning and purpose. And whatever the circumstances, there's always a journey that you can follow that is a positive one, where you can find a sense of meaning for yourself and also make a valuable contribution. I mean, you're doing far more with your life than many, many people are who are completely able-bodied, that's for sure. So, you know, it's a real credit to you that you've found that passion for this and telling these stories, or allowing people to share these stories, because it's a great account, which I think we'll see in future as we're able to dive more and more into this work. It has been an exhibition at the Te Manawa Museum. Is that ongoing?
To my knowledge, it has finished. COVID got in the way of...
Yeah, okay.
Because it was the reason the museum took on my proposal to them was that Palmerston North was going to be hosting the military tattoo in April, and so they saw what I was offering as an opportunity to contribute to that. And but it's, although it was delayed, it did end up running for a lot longer than it was intended to, and that experience in itself was great for me, because one, I felt that I had people that in a position that I, you know, really admire and respect, recognizing my work and working with me as me, Patrick, as opposed to me, the disabled Patrick. And it was a great learning experience, and it's given me a great hunger to put forward more proposals to Manawa and to build on the relationship that I've developed with them. At the same time, COVID offered me an opportunity to contribute to a documentary that was aired on Anzac Day this year, because the production company that usually does a live broadcast of the Anzac Day Memorial Service at the National War Memorial in Wellington were unable to do it due to events being cancelled. And for the first time, my interviews were put together into a, you know, professionally produced documentary and aired on, you know, TV. So that helped me a lot. It didn't matter who I was or what I was. It was the interviews spoke for themselves. So I got recognition in that way. And so, you know, I hope to be able to continue to be able to contribute in that way.
What I've noticed in just reading a couple of the news articles about your work and so on, that a lot of the media stuff I've read about your work and you does tend to focus a bit on your background and this, and it's almost framed in a way that it's like, well, look at what happened to this guy and what he's now able to do. Isn't this just wonderful, you know, that he's doing that, rather than the work itself, if you know what I mean. And whereas when I read the some testimonials or comments from people who have been working with you on these various projects and exhibitions and the website and putting the stuff together, they talk about how much you've been doing as Patrick, the historian, the documentarian who's doing this work. And it's not about you and what you're doing in spite of your disability. It's just about the work you're doing because you're good at doing it. And I think that's a really interesting distinction. Important. And as it goes on and your work gets out there more and more, there'll be people who know Patrick Bronte as the guy who he's the guy who's collected all of the war veteran stories. And that'll be the first thing they think about. And maybe they won't even know that there's any more to the story. So I think that's a really cool thing, that the work is definitely beginning to speak for itself. I wanted to maybe just finish off the interview, Pat, with asking you if there's any notable interviews or certain stories, things that stand out to you. Out of 400, I mean, I'm sure it's hard to keep track of all of those different stories, but have there been any particular ones that have really stood out for you that you could share with us now?
Yeah, so when people ask me if there are any interviews that stand out more than others, my usual response is each veteran, no matter what role they played, they still played a role. So therefore, it's just as valuable as the next guy's or next woman's experience. But there have been a few. Like, I mean, I developed quite a close relationship with a member of the Long Range Desert Group, which was the precursor to modern special forces, you could say. His name was Bill Wilcox, and I think why that particular experience with Bill and his wife stands out is that his wife asked me to speak at the funeral, and that had a major impact on me because it made me feel that I'd obviously gained the respect of a very, very hard man who had a very tough upbringing, then went to war and was doing a job that was, you know, they were 2,000 miles behind enemy lines, just with a couple of Land Rovers. So, or not Land Rovers, but I think they were driving Chevys at the time. But, you know, just it was, you know, half a dozen of them, and they were out on their own. So this guy was a very, very hard man. And I do remember him telling me off one time when I was a bit late to get to his place due to the weather and roadworks. I was a bit late, and we'd, his wife had cooked a Sunday roast for myself and my support person. So I got home, and when I listened to my phone messages, there was one from Bill telling me off that it was a waste of good cooking. But no, I got there in time. But the fact that I was asked to speak at that funeral by Bill's wife made me feel that I had earned his respect, and that meant a lot to me. That meant a lot. And another thing that comes to mind when saying that was being approached by a member of the New Zealand Deceased Association and asked if I would be interested in doing oral histories with the original members of the New Zealand Deceased who served in Malaya, and also those in Borneo and Vietnam. To be asked that, to do that, was a really big deal for me. Another that comes to mind after Bill Wilcox's story was that was Charles Chook Ferguson, who was a Hurricane pilot flying out of what was then Ceylon during the Japanese push down into the Pacific area. And he was shot down over Burma, burnt horrifically, and was just about executed by being decapitated, and it was just timing that saved his life. He talks about how maggots saved his life and the harrowing nature of being a prisoner in a Japanese prisoner of war camp at that time. That had quite an impact on me, and he was one that had not talked about it to anyone in a public manner before, and so I was really proud to be able to hand on that story to people that were researching his life and the family as well. Another big influence on me, on my whole journey, to be honest, was a man by the name of Haddon Donald, who was a recipient of Military Cross, the Distinguished Service Order, and quite a few other citations. And he was one of the first big interviews I had, I guess you could say, because he was quite open and willing to talk about it, that I didn't really need to ask so many questions. So I learned from him, from his explanation of his experience, on what questions to ask. So when I first interviewed him, I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. And, you know, he just took over, and by just listening to him, I was able to go to the next interview with a better understanding as to what to ask and how to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. And he and I remained in contact right through to his death. And he's an example of someone I interviewed on multiple occasions. I think in total I've got 12 hours of interview footage with him.
Wow.
And this guy had some of his exploits sort of make you, it's kind of funny, but they make you, you know, I used to yell at the TV if I was watching a film and it was way over the top or inaccurate or what appeared to be unrealistic. But after listening to him, it was like, wow, so many different things can happen because, you know, war is not black and white. It's so gray. And that's something that a lot of reporters, investigative journalists seem to neglect, is that, you know, there's right and wrong where they don't explore the grey areas. And I think as a result, that some of the Defence Force's latest achievements on operational deployments have been tarnished because of that lack of understanding. I'm not qualified to comment on whether it was right or wrong, but I feel that there is a tendency for the mainstream media to jump on anything negative long before they will anything positive, unless it's something major like in New Zealand have been awarded the Victoria Cross. But other than that, we don't really hear much about what these contemporary veterans have put on the line and sacrificed for our country. And because of this nature of warfare has changed so much, that it's not all about shooting and explosions. There's a lot more to it. It's about going and rebuilding a nation and or a province within a nation and providing security and allowing women to go back to school and, you know, a lot of things like that that can be far more powerful than being involved in a firefight.
Mm. Yeah, it's a much broader perspective, that's for sure. All right, Pat. Well, look, I'll wrap it up, mate. And I really appreciate your time and that we could finally get this together. And I appreciate your openness and candor with my questions. And I had a few others which you've really just answered. Thank you very much for your time, Pat. And
no worries.
I'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much. Yeah. See ya.
Okay, mate. See ya.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Here and Now podcast. You can find us on Facebook at The Here and Now Podcast or Twitter at Here Now Podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe to keep up to date with all of the latest episodes. And if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon or leave a review at the Apple Podcasts app. You can reach out to me via the pages or email thehereandnow@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.